is bird note. Though most birds that enliven beaches in summer have gone south, tiny sandpipers called sanderlings are easy to find on winter shores. They're intensely busy birds, persistently following the smallest waves as they lap in and out. High tide pushes burrowing invertebrates closer to the surface of the sand. As the waves retreat, the top layer of sand swirls loosely. Sanderlings rush in to probe the sand with their small but tough beaks, then flee as the next wave breaks. The diversity of sanderlings' diet is impressive. Various small crustaceans, especially mole crabs, isopods, and amphipods, are important elements. A sanderling's probing also yields miniature clams and bristly, segmented polychaete worms. In spring on Delaware Bay, horseshoe crab eggs are a vital food. And a sanderling's dining options don't end there. They chase invertebrates through shallow pools and pluck flying insects out of the air. In a pinch, they can turn to plants, buds, seeds, and algae. But they're best known for that elegant dance at the edge of the waves. Watch for them performing along most of the U.S. coast, from city shorelines to barrier islands. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel. This episode is dedicated to Deb Rivel for her many years of board service and generous support of Bird Note.
Yo, it's Eboshi.
Hey, this is Eboshi from Cartel Madras, and you're listening to CJSF.
I was on the back of your mind. I was on the back of your lap. You were in the back of the car. You were in the back of my heart. I was in the back of the bar. You know what I do? Take things too far. Don't know where to start or begin. Don't know how it ends. Don't know how to say what I meant. Don't know how to say how I feel. Baby, is it real? I was like 34 double Ds. You know what I like? Ice cold.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. Burnaby, BC.
Hello and welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host, Brandon, and joining me once again is Hale.
I'm looking forward to our kind of follow-up episode from the last one. It's interesting. It's going to take us some interesting places, get a little bit deeper. And it's always fun. I don't want to give too much away, but exploring new theories of the mind, the mind's limitations, and maybe even some limitations of that theory.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting, too. You talk about, like, the limitations of the theory itself. And if you're listening to this, we're going to be discussing the text of The Introduction to Metaphysics by Henry Bergson. He's elucidating, like, a methodology of metaphysics, what his conception of metaphysics is. I think we'll have some things to say about it and its limitations. But it's interesting, too, going into a text, you say, kind of exploring new theories of mind and whatnot. I've been having to, like, root around Wittgenstein and, like, Hannah Arendt's theories and whatnot. And they're all, like, very post-metaphysical. And it's easy to, like, look down on texts like this where it's like, oh, you know, it's all just, like, you know, metaphysical fallacies and stuff like that. But it is genuinely compelling to read a text that tries to, get you to have different kinds of experiences, like sympathizing with the inner being of another thing and transporting yourself into these kind of intuitive experiences of, you know, like a metaphysical sort of experience or relation with something else rather than just approaching it like analytically or relative in any case.
I think you're hinting at probably the big tension that most people will find in the work, but I think that's also in that tension is also kind of the most interesting stuff. That's what makes it interesting is that it's not all laid out there. It's not all, you know, found in a conceptual framework, as Bergson would probably think we're usually doing. Or the way we tend to think about how thinking is done.
We'll kind of go through what we discussed on the previous episode, because this is part two. We're going into the second section of this. It has three parts. The first and the third are quite short. But the second is the meat of the text, where Bergson is elucidating the experience that is necessary to sort of initiate you into having this sympathy with the inner being of another being or thing. But before we do that recap, and we'll talk about what we discussed on the first episode, I think you had quandary that you wanted to open the episode with.
I recently rewatched a film called Arrival, which I'm sure many of our listeners are familiar with. Arrival was a film from sci-fi, almost quite philosophical film from 2016 about, you know, aliens coming to Earth. And it was really interestingly well done because, unlike most alien-based films, it's not an alien invasion film, it's an alien visitation film, really. Most films like that have a tendency to portray aliens as very anthropomorphic, very human-like. Think Little Green Men riding around a spaceship that looks like a disc and all this kind of stuff. Or even just look exactly like people that are like blue or look exactly like us or whatever. This, the tendency to anthropomorphize. Arrival's very interesting and does a really good job because it really takes on the concept of speculative evolution. The aliens that arrive are completely unlike us. And the way that they're the most unlike us is that they are four-dimensional. They're temporal in the sense that they don't experience time or don't live in time in the way that we do. This is most displayed through their language. So to give a really quick synopsis of the film, the aliens start trying to communicate with human beings. So the governments bring in the world's best linguists to try and communicate with them. Eventually, through that process of trying to communicate with them as the linguist, as she learns their language, she begins to adopt their conscious experience, the way that they actually orient themselves. Her own temporality begins to change within the process of her, you know, learning how to effectively think like them. The most interesting part to me that I always thought was the kind of general conceptual view of time that begins to be displayed, which is basically, to take a step back before I reveal it, there's three primary metaphysical views of time. Now, obviously for our listeners, this gets way more complicated than this. There's all sorts of different sub-theories and all this kind of stuff. But the first one is presentism, which is kind of sometimes called nowism. And by the way, there are also many different sort of labels or terms that all kind of mean the same thing. But basically, it's the idea that, you know, time is just the present. Like, what exists is just now. So the past, whether it was us beginning the show, you know, just a few minutes ago, or 10,000 BC, all those things don't exist. And all the things that have come to pass, that will come to be, sorry, like the end of the show in, you know, a little under an hour, and, you know, 10 million years in the future, those things don't exist either. So that's presentism, that's nowism. It's not within the philosophy of time, it's not a very widely held theory, largely because it deals with the problem. I think there are some issues within the concept of physics, which I'm not even going to get into, but basically where this theory is very problematic from term physics, from the mathematical perspective. Again, way too complicated for me or the show on here with our little quandary. But the other reason, from a more standard philosophical view, is it runs into the problem of, you know, contradictory opposites, basically. You know, how does it go from existence to non-existence, right? Like, how does that transition actually even happen? And there's just like really no explanation other than like it does. The other theory is what's called possibilism, or the growing tree model, as some people call it, which is basically the past exists. So all the things that have come to pass, they are somewhere in the past, still existing in some kind of way, and the present exists, but the future has not yet be, right? So this is kind of an anti-deterministic view. There, like, the future is not real, it's always being made. As the sort of tree grows up and out, it's constantly sort of filling in that void. Again, from my understanding of light reading, there are considerable issues with this, and again, it kind of falls with the same problem as well as, well, how do you explain that transition from being to not being? The final one is called eternalism, often called the block universe theory, which is that the past, present, and future all exist in some kind of way. And that, like, and most times this theory, from a philosophical and kind of psychological perspective as well, is kind of say that, like, the notion of the nowism, the presentism, is more a feature of our own cognition. And that, in fact, there might not really be, we might say, in some to kind of be Kantian, in some noumenal, you know, the thing, the world in itself, there isn't that sort of distinction. Now, it's this eternalism, this block universe that these aliens effectively live in. They're more reflective of this, whereas in some ways you could say we're presentism. There's also ways in which you say we're possibilism, speaking about, we'll be talking a little bit about memory later in the show, obviously, with Bergson, and how some, you know, some ways, like, our memory is reflective of that past that exists and all this kind of stuff, but the future is yet to be. But eternalism, obviously, all three kind of actually exist in the same state. And to that, which is also a very deterministic view, and to that with the film, what I think it really beautifully illustrates is how, as the main character learns this alien language, she transitions into kind of a little, not fully, but a sort of getting glimpses of existing in this eternalism sort of way, and ends up seeing both her past and future all playing out, and how there are tragic decisions in her future that she now knows will happen, but she also realizes that that because it's the future and it's there as a fixed point, or like already being, there's nothing she can do to change it. And I think that's a very interesting view of how we think about time, and especially things, you know, obviously we get the sci-fi stuff like time travel or whatever it might be, where, you know, we kind of think about, well, if you know the future, then you'll do this and you'll change it and da-da-da. When in reality, it would seem much more likely that even if you did know the future, even if you had that as some sort of, you know, knowledge, you wouldn't be able to do anything about it, because your knowledge would already be, your knowing the future would already be accounted within whatever that future will be. So anything that you, like, you're already seeing all the decisions that you will make, you can't change. You can't necessarily change them. So I thought, again, I'll recommend the film for our, you know, our philosophy friends who also like film and such. I would really recommend the film, because it's really, it does a really interesting job of illustrating that. And also, too, it's based off of a short philosophical, quite philosophical short story. I'm forgetting the author, so I apologize for that. But it's called Stories of My Life, based off of which goes into it even a little bit deeper than the film does.
That's interesting. That sort of sounds like a very extreme, like, sci-fi take on, I think it's called the Sipperworth hypothesis, that, like, the language that you speak conditions the possible experience that you have, or, like, the cognitive frame that the world is going to filter through. So, like, one person might speak one language and it has this grammar for interpreting the world, and then this other person speaks a different language and that grammar sort of filters the world. As you adopt this, like, four-dimensional language, it actually starts, like, shaping, in this, like, Sipperworth way, your own experiences. So that's interesting.
Yeah, and I think that's absolutely, a component of what the film is getting at. And, you know, there are components of that that I'm quite partial to as well. And I think, you know, we'll even see, as, you know, to get into jump kind of, or a hint at Bergson a little bit, you know, there is the ways that we sort of think about how we think about things and speak about things conceptually, obviously, like Bergson, I'm sure we'll view it a little bit, but the, you know, that this conceptual dynamic has a tendency for us, like, to then how we are going to orient ourselves to the entities and persons and situations that we are familiar with, but that conceptual framework is not necessarily a equivalent of the things that we're actually encountering.
No, yeah, I mean, the concepts that we use to approach things are going to give us different views of that thing. Like, that's central to what Bergson is talking about, right? Bergson is also, in his project, going to be trying to talk about not just, like, you know, finding more or less accurate perspectives or concepts to approach things, but actually trying to argue for the project of metaphysics itself, right? Which is this idea that you can actually come to know something independent of, like, the concept of a thing, or through representation, or, like, a perspective, right? And we were going into this in our previous episode, and this is what we were talking about before, was this sort of two-way distinction that Bergson has between knowing a thing, right? He says that philosophers tend to agree that there's two ways to know a thing, maybe some philosophers argue differently, but Bergson is putting on the table two ways of knowing something particular. And I should say too, I should stress, because I was thinking about this kind of the other day, like, this is how you tend to know a thing. Maybe there are other things to know other than things, which sounds kind of weird, but, you know, maybe like events or beliefs or like general non-entities that we can still talk about. Bergson is, I think, and this is, again, like hinting to one of the things that maybe is a limitation of this. There might be things other than things, if that makes sense. And I'm thinking specifically of like, you know, I mean, I don't think the casual listener is going to be familiar with Nagarjuna, but Nagarjuna would be someone who says like, really, things are conventions. There aren't actually essentially things, right? Which is like an anti kind of meta. It would be counter to Bergson's project, but I just want to put on the table that like Bergson is making some like metaphysical assumptions by saying that he kind of packages, he brings in the back door the idea of a thing, right?
Well, I think I was going to say with Nagarjuna, I think that there's a similar, not that it's been a long time since I've read Nagarjuna, but again, there's like I think there's two different avenues going on from a similar realization. Again, with the conceptualization and, you know, obviously the language that goes along with conceptualization. On the one hand, Nagarjuna, there's a sort of a sort of negation, obviously, going on. Where it's like, well, actually, the reference doesn't actually exist, basically, right? Whereas with Bergson, as we'll get into it, there's this, you know, the idea of sympathy and intuitionism, where it's like, okay, we have to do a different yes, our language, our usual language, our usual conceptual frameworks don't actually get at the things that we think we're getting at when we're talking about them or thinking about them or using them or whatever it might be. So we have to find different ways, new ways of doing that.
I should get into the distinction itself, though. I'm kind of doing the bad thing of criticizing something before having even explicated what it is I'm criticizing. In any case, the first part that we discussed in part one concerns this distinction that Bergson draws between two ways of knowing a thing. The first way he calls the relative way, and the second way he calls the absolute way. The relative way is predicated upon taking a perspective on something, right? And this produces a multitude of appearances of that thing because you can take various perspectives on a thing. The key for Bergson, though, is that a perspective is always outside of the thing that you're inspecting or looking at, right? Bergson says that the absolute way of knowing something dispenses with perspective. It dispenses with the relativity, the multitude of ways that a thing can appear by going into the being of whatever it is that you want to know absolutely itself, right? Which would be perspectiveless, right? Because you would be in sympathy with and sort of taking the perspective of that thing itself. And that dispenses with symbols. It dispenses with any kind of concepts or particularities of how that thing is viewed. So it is completely immediate. Bergson is saying that the way to do this is to have an intuition. An intuition being like a pre-conceptual experience of the thing, projecting yourself into the being of that thing to have an experience as that would be how you would know something absolutely. So the metaphor or the example he gives, understanding a character in a novel. To understand a character relatively, you would, you know, you'd make a list of like all the traits that are exemplified in the book, the events that happen, all the things they say, and you try and like additively understand what that character is and like what their motivations are. Whereas understanding a character absolutely would kind of be like, you know, imagine what an actor does when they have to portray a character, right? They have to get in character. They have to be the character. They don't have a separate, distinct perspective on that character because they're playing that character. They're depicting them. And that would be one and sort of that's one example that Bergson says. The other thing, too, is that when you do that, you can dispense with all of the you can dispense with the book. because you can now be spontaneous in that. You have the experience of being that character. And so it's almost generative in that sense too, which I think is kind of an interesting implication. But in any case, that is Bergson's distinction that he explores. And metaphysics is the science of knowing things, absolutely, he says.
Yeah, I think that that's a pretty good synopsis of like the first part of Bergson's whole project, and also highlights, as we kind of opened, a little bit of the, you know, the tension that goes on, because as you said, like the metaphysics is the process or the school of knowing things in themselves, and there's many different metaphysicians have attempted this. We can think about someone like Aristotle, who would say that the four causes is one. I mean, obviously he says a lot more than that, but there's, you know, to understand what a thing really is, or we can have a Platonic view that like there must be some wider referential framework. I even think in more modern terms, obviously bring them up all the time, but someone like Heidegger would say that this encounter, this intuitionism, a little bit, again, gross simplification, but this happens in use, right? Like it happens as things are, beings and people are ready to hand as we interact with them, before any kind of contemplation, that's when we're actually in a sort of intuitive relationship with whatever entities or stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think too about like Kant saying like there has to be a cause. Appearances must have a non-appearing cause. Metaphysics has been tried, and Bergson is taking a pretty bold step in trying to establish the science of metaphysics, as much as it's been kind of shot down in the past. It's interesting to read, and it does like reflect experiences that I think are worth having, trying to be in sympathy with something, trying to understand something in that way. Bergson wants to say, okay, if this science of metaphysics is going to be possible, and if knowing something absolutely is having an intuitive experience of being the inner being of that thing and sharing the experience and having those experiences preconceptually of something, the question is, okay, well, how do you do that, right? Like, what would that even look like? And Bergson opens the second part by saying that, well, if there is one inner being that we intuitively understand sort of pre-metaphysically, it's our own. It's our own experiences. And what we need to do is we need to come to understand the actual nature, and even like this is going to be the paradox of part two, right? Because what Bergson is going to try and do is he is going to try to give an analysis of intuition. Now, in part one, he says that this is actually impossible, and analysis and intuition are two opposites. They're on the opposite side of the coin, right? Analysis always is the breaking down of an experience, right? So say, for example, you look at a cup, right? Well, if you're going to break down and analyze that cup into the container and the handle on it and then its contents, if you're going to start abstracting those parts from one another, you have to first have that intuitive given experience, right? So analysis always follows intuition. Bringing someone to that intuition, though, is a totally different matter. And he can use words to try and gesture to and try to bring someone to that experience, but no amount of sort of talk, even, I guess we could just like trivialize it as, maybe, I don't know if Bergson would say that, but he does specifically say like, all of the things that I'm going to say here are kind of paradoxical. I think that we can learn a lot from the way that Bergson goes on about this, but it has to be borne in mind that when Bergson is giving the metaphors and the images and the analysis that he is giving, it has to be borne in mind that these are analyses. If you really pay attention to the experience that you're having when you are trying to understand this stuff, right now you are listening to this podcast. That is the experience you're having. If I'm on the, you know, I'm on the bus and I'm reading the Introduction to Metaphysics and I ask myself, well, what is the intuition of a thing? That's what it would be. But right now I'm recording this show. You have to be honest about the experiences that you're having. And that exercise of what he calls he calls it direct attention or intuitive attention, the effort of attention. If as you're learning to sort of exercise that, that is what he's specifically talking about. But in any case, I'm extrapolating a little bit. So Bergson is going to say that if we're going to sympathize with the inner being of something, the way that we're going to do that is we're going to understand our own experience. And then what we will do is through an imaginative effort, we will imagine the experience of the inner being that we want to understand, right? So it's a sort of, it's a transposition of one's own experience upon something else, right? But I don't think that that's necessarily like, you know, it's, as soon as I encountered that, it was easy for me to be like, okay, well, it would seem like this is just like you putting whatever you want to kind of see into it. But again, think back to what I was saying about this intuitive attention that you have to exercise and you have to be honest with it, right? You can't fool yourself about the experiences that you're having. That's a sort of way of filtering out all of the like fantasy or whatever you want to just see in the inner being of something, right? So there kind of it actually is something here. If you have a way of clearing up your own self-understanding and you get really good at having an intuitive understanding of the experiences that you have yourself, when you go to understand the intuitive being of something else, you should be practiced at filtering out your own sort of desires or whatever baggage that your imagination wants to bring in. It's a clarification. I think it's a way of clarifying the imagination.
We're transitioning in some sense to perhaps a more poetic way of thinking, where we're not using, okay, like try and get rid of shared direct conceptual frameworks that we extrapolate from a thing or try to use to describe a thing or communicate a thing or whatever it might be, and instead like be intuitive and focus on one's like own uninhibited experience and encounter. I call that kind of poetic because it's this sort of you end up with a sort of like unique expression in some sort of way. I also do, it does make me wonder like how is that process like necessarily possible when even that described process is part of a shared sort of conceptual framework. One thing that always comes to me in another paper that has some similarities and more in focusing on the tension or the impossible jump. I think last episode we did talk about Thomas Nagel's What It's Like to Be a Bat, wherein like the being, the existence of, you know, the creature, the bat, is just, it's just not something that we could ever know, right? Like there's no amount of language, there's no amount of data or whatever it might be that would allow us to be like, oh, I'm bat now. Even if we did think we were making that jump, we would in fact be stuck in this point of being that being that's making that jump into that thing, which is also not the thing itself.
I remember reading Wittgenstein for the first time. I know we're like getting kind of anti-metaphysical, but I think these are worth bringing up. We'll go into more of what Bergson has to say about this, because I do think that Bergson wants to establish metaphysics as a science, and sciences aren't exact when they start. We have to establish the sort of principles and then refine the tools. We might just have like really like not good tools for it right now. But in any case, maybe that's a sympathetic way of sort of saving Bergson's project. Like I remember when I started reading Wittgenstein, I realized that even if I like, let's say, oh my God, it happens, I become the bat. Okay, well, guess what? Like the problem is just now replicated in bat form, right? Because now like, oh, how do I know like other bats and stuff like that, even though I have my own bat? Wittgenstein's point is even more radical, where he's like, you don't even know your own with the beetle in the box. I mean, you look inside the box, but you don't have like, and you just have the word beetle for whatever you're looking at.
The problem gets deeper. How can you even know yourself? Well, you know, there's the kind of existential problem of, You know, you think that you know who you are, but really what you know is this conscious experience that has this sort of internalized label of you as your identity. But there's also presumed